Welcome to Screen Talk, everybody. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large at IndieWire, and as always, joined by Ryan Latanzio, who runs all things news, managing, editing, all sorts of stuff out of New York. So we're going to start off. What do you think? Should we start with The Color Purple? Should we just go straight there?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that was definitely, you know, that's the most recent movie to break into the conversation. And I'm not going to see it until next week. But Anne, I know you saw it. So let's
you didn't see it. So I'm going to say that it's a rousing, entertaining movie, that the story itself, the original story, the one that fueled the last version of the movie and the musical that this one is based on, is a strong, powerful, emotional story. And those characters, Celie, played very well by Fantasia Barrino, who played it on, it was a singer, and she played it on Broadway. And then you have the character Sophia. And again, Danielle Brooks plays the part that was played by Oprah Winfrey. And back in 1996, she actually got nominated for that. There were three acting nominations back in 1986, and I'm not sure they're going to repeat that feat this time against all the competition. But the question of whether it holds up is interesting as a musical. I wasn't enthralled by all the big musical numbers that keep coming forward. That wasn't what sold me. What sold me was the story. And it's a very good, strong, emotional story.
I saw the musical on Broadway back in 2017 with a totally different cast who are not any of these people. In this film, you know, which is based on the Alice Walker novel, which Steven Spielberg previously tackled in 1985 with his movie that got 11 Oscar nominations and won none of them, which remains, I believe, a kind of record.
Well, I think The Irishman is in there with 10. It's close.
Yeah. We've got Fantasia as Celie, Taraji P. Henson as Shug, which was played by Avery in the previous film. But the breakout of the movie seems to be Danielle Brooks as Sophia, who got a Tony nomination for what was her Broadway debut in the musical. And, you know, she had a long run on TV in Orange is the New Black, and she now seems, based on the reactions, to be the sort of real breakout winner of this movie.
Because she elicits emotion. And some people were bugging me. They were, why didn't you put in Taraji P. Henson? You know, this is on Twitter, my tweet. And I said, it's Taraji P. Henson is fabulous. I mean, she's supporting Celie. She plays a very valuable role, and she's very entertaining and fun to watch. But she doesn't have that depth of emotion that Sophia has.
And having not seen
Domingo is very good, by the way, as Mister. He's very good.
Which was Danny Glover in the Spielberg movie, who's a very detestable, unlikable character.
And yet you're certainly by the end, you're oddly rooting for him. He's a terrible character. And yet you understand that this is the cycle, that the pain and the trauma and the, you know, bad parenting just gets passed on and on and on.
I don't remember the music in the stage version wasn't particularly memorable. And that was a criticism of the show when it played for many years. And so I feel like that's got to apply to the movie as well, right?
Well, you have these big, big musical numbers. It actually starts off very well. I like the way it started. It's more naturalistic. It's just two characters up on a tree branch, you know, singing to each other. What you have, though, are these enormous tableaus that just sort of sit there. They don't really come to life. At least I don't think they do. There's another musical that I would like to suggest may be more effective as a musical, but we're not allowed to talk about it yet. One of the year-end movies.
Yeah, so we cannot speak about Wonka, which we have both seen, but it is under strict embargo. We cannot even address it. And I'm sure we both have many thoughts about it that we will. I think that the social embargo on this one is Tuesday of next week. So
Yeah. So we'll talk about it on the next podcast. I saw a movie last night that I had heard good things about, which is Matteo Garrone's Io Capitano, which is the Italian entry for the Oscar. And it's a rather extraordinary movie that follows two Sudanese teenagers, they're 16, from Darfur. And if you look at the map of Africa, Darfur is way the hell over on the west coast of Africa. And they have to go all the way up through the desert and all the way up to Libya, to Tripoli, to get into a boat to take them over to Sicily. And this journey is harrowing and also oddly beautiful because it goes through extraordinary terrain and they go through extraordinarily difficult, traumatic stuff. I mean, they almost get killed, both of them. So it's a good movie. I highly recommend it. It isn't, I mean, I don't want people to think, oh, it's just another migrant journey, because it's more than that.
Yeah, well, it played at Venice when I was there and I didn't see it. And perhaps it's because I sort of had that feeling. But where do you feel like it could possibly end up in the international feature rate?
The short list is 15 films, right? So in December, there will be an announcement of the shortlist, and all the different voters are you know, going through and showing up and watching all these films. To their credit, I have to say, it's a lot of work. So I'm not worried about that. Whether it makes the final five, I think it has the right stuff to do that. But again, you know, I did a story about Teacher's Lounge, which is the German entry, The Teacher's Lounge, which is a very strong movie that won all the German film awards and beat out a lot of strong competition to be submitted, kind of broke out of Berlin last year. And Sony Pictures Classics picked it up. And there's, of course, The Zone of Interest, which no one is going to beat, I don't think. It's the UK entry in German. And then there's Society of the Snow, the J.A. Bayona movie, which I think is really good, you know, about the Uruguayan rugby team stranded in the mountains. So, you know, there's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the Bayona film, Society of the Snow, I saw out of Venice, and I've got some writing to do about that one next week. What's interesting about that one is we sort of know this story already from this early 90s movie, Alive, with Ethan Hawke and so forth, but this movie is actually working with real Uruguayan people and telling the story more from their perspective in a way that isn't...
It took him a long time to get made because of that, because he insisted on doing it in Spanish, Uruguayan Spanish.
And that one is opening next Friday, but then it's going to be on Netflix in January. And it's definitely one that I would say a theatrical experience lends to rather than watching it at home. I mean, there's really, you know, he's the director of The Impossible. We know what he's capable of, but there's a lot of incredible special effects scenes just involving this plane crash and just the struggle for survival that the remaining people have that I think are really worth seeing on a big screen. You know, we were talking about the movies that we hope that people might pull out of their screener piles and sort of revisit possibly over the holiday, as the studios have sent out many of these to everyone at this point. And one of them I was thinking about was the Icelandic entry, Godland.
I still have to see that.
Almason, which is super great. It sort of evokes a Herzog, Aguirre, Wrath of God kind of story about a Danish Lutheran priest in Iceland whose faith is tested. And the filmmaking is just really impressive. And I don't know that that's going to get to the final five, but it's one that I would encourage many people to see because it's now streaming on Criterion Channel. So it is available.
Yeah, I made some notes about some things that, all right. So on Netflix now is The Killer, which is the David Fincher movie with Michael Fassbender, which is a must-see. I mean, it's just so beautifully made. It is so precise and so extraordinarily controlled. I think it's one of my favorite David Fincher movies. He's tracking an assassin who is on a vengeful course of action. And then you have also on Netflix, American Symphony, from Matt Heineman, who's one of our best documentary filmmakers. And it's a really extraordinary story about, you know, you think it's about Jean Baptiste and he's writing a symphony. And he's, of course, the guy who used to be on late night TV. He is dealing with the fact that his wife has had a recurrence of cancer and she's actually under great duress. There's no guarantees that she's going to pull through. And so this is a very fraught, dramatic situation that Heinemann has the skill to just be up close with it. And then the other one that is similar in a way is The Eternal Memory. And that's available now. And that's the Maite Alberti Chilean story of two.
Which is beautiful and devastating. I'm going to catch up on American Symphony in the coming days. What I will say about The Killer is you say that it's really controlled, but I think that that movie comes off the hinges in a good way. Like, I think he loosens up a bit more than usual. And that's even reflective in the cinematography, which for the first time that I can remember in a Fincher movie becomes handheld at some points. And I do think that that movie, it's interesting. It's almost sort of autobiographical in a way, because it's about this meticulous assassin who kind of unravels because his perfectionism starts to falter. And I can see that as being
he makes one mistake and it throws him completely.
Yeah, and that's probably exactly what goes through a Fincher mindset when he's making any movie. As we know, he is one of the most control freak directors that there is.
There's something very elemental, I mean, maybe deceptively so. You know, it seems very austere and simple, this movie. And there's something about it that I find super cool. You know, it's so fun to watch because it's so beautiful.
He's one of those directors, like with Ridley Scott, even though I didn't love Napoleon the way you did, you go and you sit down in the theater and you know that you are in
your hands of a master.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right. And then the other movie that I thought I might check out, I don't know if you saw it, is the Albert Brooks Defending My Life, directed
which
by...
Which I haven't, Ryder. Even though I love Defending My Life, the actual Albert Brooks movie, and I'm a huge fan of his. But this is the Rob Reiner directed documentary
that played
a couple festivals this fall. A couple that I wanted to single out actually started in Sundance, which were the A.V. Rockwell film, 1001, starring Taylor, which is fabulous. And she gives a really great performance as this New York woman in the early 90s who gets out of incarceration and kidnaps her son out of the foster care system. And then it's about how they build a life together over the coming decades. It really, you know, she's been in a lot of Tyler Perry movies and I haven't seen many of those. She's more known as a musician, but it really is an incredible breakout performance. And I know that Focus Features is kind of really pushing that one, as they should. I mean,
I think it'll do very well at the Spirit Awards, I would say. Yeah. And we'll see about that. You know what's coming? It's going to be on Paramount Plus, of all things, over the holiday. Master and Commander, my favorite seafaring movie.
I've not thought about that one in a while. But
the old Russell Crouch in his prime chestnut. I love that movie. I'm going to definitely watch it over the holiday. I'm going to indulge myself.
Well, you know, one of the movies that we wanted to talk about that I was just revisiting this morning in preparation for this was Love Actually, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary.
Unbelievable.
And which remains a movie that people constantly revisit, no matter the occasion, but it is a sort of perennial
Christmas movie.
It is a Christmas movie, and it's set in the lead up to Christmas. You know, it's interesting, like this movie, I didn't see it when it first came out, and it's been sort of shoved down my throat over the years. And I finally did watch it for the first time a few years ago. I'm not super crazy about it, but I understand that its enduring appeal comes a lot from the cast, which includes Alan Rickman, Emma Thompson, Laura Linney, Bill Nighy, all of these people.
Hugh Grant,
of course. And it's also interesting
Liam Neeson.
No, I mean, there is a panoply of characters that it's almost like the Paul Haggis' Crash of a romantic comedy. It's sort of hard to keep track of everything that's going on. What is your relationship to this movie?
Well, I first saw it when it came out, and I thought it's Richard Curtis's first film as a director.
That's right.
Now, he wrote a lot of things that we love, like Notting
Bridget
Hill.
Jones, Notting Hill.
These are
so we
movies
think
that I
of him
really...
as this rom-com auteur, but this was his first.
But he's a very gifted writer, and he's someone where I would watch those over and over and over again. Also, there would be something so gratifying about that, you know, Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts, her scene telling him that she's just a girl, you know, wanting to be loved. You know, there's something incredible about that. So I ended up watching it at Christmas with my daughter year after year after year, and it grew on me. There are several different stories interlocking over the course of it that you go back and forth, and they each develop in a different way. But the one with Laura Linney and her workmate, the gorgeous guy in her office,
Rodrigo Santoro.
Very nice on the eyes, but not my favorite, not my favorite one, you know, but there's a scene in with those two that is so terribly shot and lit and executed that it just makes me wince. But it was his first time directing, and he, you know, he's gotten better since then. And the movie just, it just makes you happy to watch it. It sits well over the years.
I agree that the Laura Linney character does get a kind of short shrift in it. And I think she's even addressed that over the years. The moment that I really like is involves Emma Thompson. She's married to Alan Rickman in the movie, who's having an affair with his secretary.
Or wants to. Yeah.
That's right. And she thinks she's getting this necklace that she discovered for Christmas. And she ends up getting a Joni Mitchell CD. I wouldn't be unhappy about that personally. But she realizes, right, that he is being unfaithful, however emotionally or psychically. And, you know, she has this sort of breakdown about this gift. And what's interesting about it is that Emma Thompson has said that she really was channeling the moment when she found out that her former partner, Kenneth Branagh, was having an affair with Helena Bonham Carter. So for her, it's like she's really sort of acting something
it's
out.
It's a great scene. Great scene. And Alan Rickman is really good in it. And Hugh Grant is delicious, you know. I mean, I will watch the whole sequence of him dancing in, you know, and or the scene where he knocks on all the doors and looking for the woman who used to work for him, who he's in love with. You know, these are great, great sequences.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of the material, he is always charming. We will talk about him in Wonka next week.
That's right. That's
but,
up.
You know, interestingly, Richard Curtis wrote a new movie, Jeannie, starring Melissa McCarthy, that's going to be on Peacock, or I think it now is on Peacock. It's been horribly reviewed. And he's only directed one movie since Love Actually, which was About Time, which is another one
which
that
I really like,
sort of
actually.
Cult of appreciation around it.
Rachel McAdams,
Another piece of news that broke yesterday was about the fate of the bike riders. New Regency now looking for a new distributor outside of 20th Century Disney, with whom they have had a production deal. They made The Creator together earlier this year, which didn't do
I think
super
Amsterdam
well.
Was part of that deal.
That's right. Also. That's right. Another one that didn't do well.
Also another movie that doesn't feel like a Disney movie.
It doesn't.
You know?
These feel like search. I mean, it's like Amsterdam, bike riders. These feel like Searchlight.
Searchlight.
Movies.
But they can't because of legal language in their deal.
No, that's right. And they already pushed the date of Bike Riders due to the strike. And so it's not opening this year. So now they're sort of seeking other options for when it could potentially open next year. I'm sure you guys talked about it on the podcast before I came on, but what were your thoughts about the potential of that movie?
Bike Riders is a tweener, is my answer. It's a really interesting movie. It's unusual. It's unconventional. It's adapted from a photo book. It doesn't have a conventional narrative structure, but it has these three fabulous actors playing bike riders. I mean, the woman is the girlfriend. Jodie Comer, really good. Austin Butler, very good. And the always fabulous Tom Hardy. I never thought it was a very commercial movie. And I thought that if there was a group of people that would respond really well to it, it would be the Academy actors. And that's still true. So they're looking. I'm curious to see what they discover. I think the people who made the movie feel very strongly that they have an awards movie and that it should be supported as such. And they're looking for that kind of belief. I think Disney's planning to put it out next year and let it go, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the bike riders struggles a little bit in the way that Jeff Nichols movies often does. I mean, it's sort of going for this easy rider kind of vibe, but then I honestly, it kind of reminded me more of the David O. Russell movie, The Fighter, in the sense that there's a lot of acting with a capital A that's going on among this ensemble. But I
and
do
fighting
feel that
and real violence.
Yes, and that too. And I do feel like it has potential beyond just being a streaming movie. Whether or not how commercial it is, I can't say, but there is real love for this one. And hopefully it, you know, whether Disney or wherever else, I can imagine it will succeed wherever it lands ultimately.
Jeff Nichols is a really gifted filmmaker, but he's not necessarily somebody who has his eye on the audience. I don't think he has commercial instincts. I think his instincts are much more interesting. I think he's trying to try different things, and you know, this movie is you can feel it. It's organic. It has a weird narrative shape that came out of, you know, years of development and whatever they found on the set. So it doesn't have the familiar hallmarks of something that an audience could hang on to.
No, and it's like you look at his filmography, there's nothing really commercial going on there, even with the sort of sci-fi mainstream play of Midnight Special. But going back to his debut, Take Shelter, which is really interesting and complicated, and something like Mud, you know, he's never really had the.
And he discovers actors. He does well with actors. His actors are. What was the name of the young actor in Mud who he discovered? I want to say Ty Sheridan. Is that possible?
Ty Sheridan, who was in the Clooney movie a couple years ago.
Yeah, that's what's going on there. And we are going to take off and have a good turkey day, Ryan.
Yeah, you too. Fun? Happy Thanksgiving. We're both off the hook for hosting this year. So hopefully it's a relaxing day for us.
I get to make a few dishes and go to a friend's house. I'm so grateful.
All right. We'll have a good holiday and we'll talk next week.
Next week. Bye-bye.